This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Issues in the era of devastating environmental news. At 10 here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features a weekly report on occupied Palestine with Nora Barrows-Friedman and the electronicintifada.net. At 11, it's the Recovery Zone with host Stephanie Potter. At 11:30, Stephanie continues interviewing author Virginia Morell on her book, Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and click on the little jar that says Donate Today. This KBOO program is brought to you by KBOO Foundation and a grant from Ben's Les Schwab Amphitheater, presenting alternative rock band Cake and Icelandic rock band Sigur Rós over Memorial Day weekend. Cake and Sigur Rós tickets are available Friday at bendconcerts.com.
A little fun there with Leslie Gore and You Don't Own Me. Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. My guest is Buck Parker, who has worked with the nonprofit Earth Justice since 1980. Earth Justice is a public interest law firm dedicated to protecting the earth and to defending the right of all people to a healthy environment. Buck was litigation coordinator and then executive director of that organization. He is now strategic advisor. Buck Parker will be speaking tonight in Portland as part of the Illihi Lecture Series, Who Owns You? And What You Can Do About It. His topic tonight is Who Owns Your Environment? That's at 7 tonight at the First Congregational Church at 1123 Southwest Park Avenue. This talk can be heard also tonight on KBOO Radio, live at 7 p.m. Buck Parker, thanks for being on KBOO this morning.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Now, there's a quote that is included in your biographical material. You say, "When I was 12 or 13, we watched the dam at the Dalles being built. It was my first introduction to the damage that could be done environmentally and culturally when you let others define what is progress." Can you talk about how that helped inspire you to do the work that you've done now for, I guess, 30 to 40 years?
Well, I suppose you have to understand how wonderful Celilo Falls was and the Indian and cultural way of life that had developed around it. And so I had always just assumed that that was something that had always been that way and always would be that way. So I was astonished to realize that a government agency and or the federal government, which I was just beginning to sort of understand from civics how all of this worked, would actually just come in and destroy all of that. And it just, it made me more aware of the role of government and of industries and their impact on the environment and their impact on people. And then I, as I got older, I realized that, you know, I think in my mind of a young person, a forest ranger was sort of like a national park ranger. But I began to realize as I saw clear cuts and happening that, no, that's not quite the way it was. So it just sort of, it made me more aware of the power of government and of industries to affect our environment.
And were you thinking of that awareness when you became a lawyer?
Well, that awareness stayed with me. And when I became a lawyer, I certainly was interested in environmental law. when I went to law school way back in the, I graduated in 1972, most schools didn't teach environmental law. It really wasn't a field yet. But there were some courses that touched on it, and I took those courses when I could. And although I went into private practice and I was here in Portland, a part of what I did always was volunteer some of my time for organizations like the Sierra Club or Oregon Environmental Council. And that slowly pulled me into environmental law and the realization that I wanted to do that kind of work full time.
And you started working at Earth Justice in 1980. What were the big legal environmental battles at that time?
A lot of what we were doing in 1980s, Earth Justice was at that time called Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund, by the way, and we were not a part of the Sierra Club, but we worked closely with the Sierra Club and a large number of other organizations. And our central focus at that time was public lands issues throughout the West. We were we had an office in Washington, D.C., but we were largely a Western organization, and the National Forests and the Bureau of Land Management lands were our primary concern. But we were reaching out into some of the more health-related type of work under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, and that developed a lot during the 1980s. And today we still do quite a bit of work on public lands and endangered species, but we also have very active legal programs around energy issues and around public health issues.
And I assume that one area of your intense involvement in the earlier times of your work was the northern spotted owl fight.
That's correct. Earth Justice was the organization that did most of the legal work on the spotted owl battles and brought those cases. And it really was probably the first time that we had brought cases with such a large-scale impact. Prior to that, when we were challenging forestry decisions, it was usually an individual timber sale or something like that. And the spotted owl litigation, of course, affected a broad swath of national forests up and down the Pacific coast. And actually, the result of that litigation was to change forever the way the federal land agencies do their planning, because that resulted in the Northwest Forest Plan, which was the first time there was a planning for national forest lands on such a large scale. And later on, that served as a model for the Sierra Plan in California and for planning for the Tongass National Forest, for instance, in Alaska. So it was groundbreaking in many ways.
And what was your role in that whole activity?
My role in that was I was not a direct litigator. I was still in the position that you mentioned called litigation coordinator, in that I very loosely managed the attorneys and worked with the clients as well. But I was not handling the litigation. I was overseeing it.
I'm speaking with Buck Parker, who is strategic advisor at Earth Justice. He is speaking tonight at the Illahee Lecture Series. The lecture series is on who owns you and what you can do about it. His topic is who owns your environment. That's at 7 p.m. tonight at the First Congregational Church. And KBOO is broadcasting this event live tonight at 7 p.m. So, Buck Parker, thinking of this idea of who owns your environment, if you try to go back to that time of the whole spotted owl fight, what would you say about the issue of who owns your environment at that time?
Well, at that time, we were talking about specifically the national forests, and certainly the timber industry, in one way or another, was the biggest, most influential player in national forest decisions. Over time, the forestry schools were really preparing people for careers in the timber industry, and the Forest Service tended to view itself as a servant of the timber industry. The fact was that timber logging was changing in the Northwest anyway, because almost all of the old growth forest, at least the low elevation old growth forest, was gone by then. There was only about 15% left. And the timber industry would have run out of that old growth forest probably within the next 15 years anyway. What we did was bring suits in time to try to save what little of it remained. And as it turned out, the Forest Service, or the timber industry, was about to become a less important player in the Northwest than it had been. To a certain degree, I thought that it was living on borrowed time. It had been assumed that it was very powerful, and I think people assumed that it accounted for more jobs than it actually did. In some ways, the litigation exposed the timber industry as being on the verge of perhaps moving out of the region and establishing itself more solidly in the South, and also moving to second growth timber. But anyway, a long story, but the timber industry was the major influence over public lands in the Northwest at the time.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the second big area of environmental justice work or environmental litigation work that you dealt with sort of related to that, and that was the whole issue of the roadless areas. Can you talk about that and the roadless rule in the 1990s and what that involved?
Well, as you probably know, the roadless rule, which protected about 58 million acres of unroaded lands on national forests throughout the country, was promulgated in the very last days of the Clinton administration. And the George W. Bush administration came in intent on repealing that. It was clear that part of their strategy was going to be to work with industry and let industry bring lawsuits to overturn the roadless rule, which would probably not be strongly defended by the Bush administration in the courts. Consequently, Earth Justice stepped in and intervened in every case brought by the timber industry and some western states to protect the roadless rule. And it was a very long, hard battle. I think that at one time there were something like 18 or 19 different cases going on, not all of them active at one time. And we intervened in every single one of those. And ultimately, did prevail, and to almost to my astonishment, after 8 years of steady assault and the friendliest administration they could have hoped to have, the roadless rule still stands.
Hmm. And there's one exception to the areas that you fought for, I understand?
The exception is probably in Idaho, if that's what you're thinking of. There was Idaho did manage to promulgate or to get through a special exemption, and some land there that would have fallen under the roadless rule got out from under it. But I think that's probably what you're referring to.
Read a reference or saw a reference to the Tongass?
The Tongass is a bit of a different thing, yes. The Tongass, the Bush administration did manage to promulgate a rule exempting the Tongass. And we challenged that exemption and overturned it. So the Tongass is back.
Oh, great.
Back underneath.
I'm speaking with Buck Parker, and he is speaking tonight at the Ilahi Lecture Series on Who Owns You and What You Can Do About It. And his topic is Who Owns Your Environment? And you mentioned earlier that issues have changed since the spotted owl was foremost in some environmental litigation issues. And now you mentioned energy. And can you discuss that a little bit more about how issues, particularly in the Northwest, that Earth Justice is fighting, have evolved, and what is the concentration now?
Well, certainly in the last 15 or 20 years, everyone has become much more aware of climate change or global warming and the contribution that the fossil fuel industry makes to that, and particularly coal-fired power plants. So Earth Justice has moved very strongly into that field, challenging plans to construct new coal-fired power plants in several places around the country, and working with a broad coalition of other lawyers and other conservation groups, environmental groups, doing this work. In the Northwest, that takes the form of challenging plans for coal exports, of course.
And how is the litigation going in that area?
You know, I would... I'm not really the best person to talk about that because I have been away from that work, and I only work part-time for Earth Justice right now. But I would encourage you to sometime talk with Jan Hasselman, who is our attorney in our Seattle office, who is handling that.
Okay. What do you think... How do you view litigation as a tool in the modern environmental movement at this point, having worked in this area for so long?
Well, it's become more complicated. It is still probably the single most effective tool that environmentalists have. I mean, the environmental movement, law has played a very large role in it, because essentially what the environmentalists did in the 60s and 70s was to get first the federal government and then the states to enact various laws which would curb the worst excesses of private industry or citizens or even government agencies themselves. But the effectiveness of all of that, of course, depends on those laws being enforced. And so the environmental movement is known somewhat for going to court when all else fails to force that. Some of the differences are that the law has become more complex over the years, and we've also realized and learned that you have to be prepared to stay with an issue for a couple of decades to really have an impact, even with the being able to go to court. It's not just a matter of getting one decision and setting a precedent and then going on and doing something else. You really have to stay with the issue to make sure that court orders are followed and watchdog the agencies and industries involved. So one of the strengths of Earth Justice is that we are able to make the commitment to stay with an issue for a very, very long time, because that's what it takes to really have an impact these days, even with the law.
Mm-hmm. And when you look around nationally at the issues, the legal issues that are part of the whole fight around climate change and global warming, how long do you see those going on?
Those will be with us for a very long time. We realize that this is not something that we're going to do for 5 years or 10 years and then be done with it. But what we really need is also federal legislation that will address the climate change issues and empower the administration to deal with them. Right now, Congress is pretty much deadlocked on climate change as on everything else, with the Republican Party being sort of divided between those who deny that climate change is happening and those who admit that it is happening but sort of attack the causes and the science underlying it. And that has led to a paralysis at the federal level. So a lot of the significant action on climate change is actually being taken at the state and local level, but we really need to have the federal government in there as a major player too.
And you talked about your work and Earth Justice's work in the Bush years when the policies were so harsh and so much was done to fight against the kind of work that you were doing. How do you see what's happening now with this administration?
Well, the truth is, regardless of whether you have a Democrat or a Republican in office, you always need to be able to bring lawsuits. The differences may be that you are simply under the Bush administration trying purely to stop bad projects from going forward, and that in itself was a major victory. When you're dealing with an administration that is perhaps more sympathetic to environmental concerns, there's the chance that you, a better chance that you can also catalyze some new and more positive behavior as well as just stopping the bad behavior. Of course, President Obama has had to deal a lot with a bad economy, and a lot of environmental issues have wound up on the administration's back burner. So one of the ways we use litigation, frankly, is to put those issues on the front burner so that the administration has to deal with them.
By just keeping them in the public and keeping your fight going?
By keeping the fight going and by getting court orders that various statutes be implemented. One of the biggest things that has happened actually in climate change at the federal level is getting the Environmental Protection Agency to exercise its authority under the Clean Air Act to promulgate regulations governing emissions of carbon dioxide from coal-fired power plants. And the clarification that EPA had that authority under the Clean Air Act, which the Bush administration had denied, came about as a result of some litigation which was carried on by the states that actually had been thought through the strategy by an Earth Justice lawyer in Washington, D.C. So it's a perfect example, it's a really good example of how litigation was used to get a ruling from the courts that carbon dioxide was indeed a pollutant as they were defined under the Clean Air Act, and that EPA did have the authority to regulate them, and EPA has the authority to address the climate change issue. But that came about as a result of a court case.
Hmm. Buck Parker, what your talk tonight, Who Owns Your Environment? Can you give us a little preview of what the focus is going to be?
Yes, I want to talk about two things, really. One is the incredible shift that has taken place within the Republican Party over the last three decades, from being a strongly environmental party that had supported many of the very statutes that Republicans are attacking now. But people forget, or just simply don't know because they're now too young, that in the 1970s, statutes like the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, passed Congress with very, very strong Republican support. And you would never believe that today. So I want to talk a little bit about that shift that took place and just how radical it has been for someone who lived through that time and has followed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to talk about what this may mean in the area of climate change. And in particular, I want to talk about the issue, the question of black carbon or soot. It is a relatively new issue in terms of global warming, but the role that plain old ordinary soot, particularly from diesel emissions, has in global in contributing to climate change is turning out to be much, much bigger than anyone thought a few years ago. And it's a relatively easy pollutant to control. You don't have to shut down any industry. You simply have to retrofit diesel engines with pollution controls or replace older engines with newer, more efficient ones. And you can have a positive effect on global warming within a very short time, because soot actually falls out of the atmosphere in about 2 to 4 weeks. So we have this unexpected opportunity. It's not an alternative to reducing fossil fuel consumption and carbon dioxide. That problem absolutely has to be dealt with. But if we could deal right away with the soot, which is called black carbon in the discussions, issue, we could delay some of the worst impacts of global warming while we address those other questions that have to be addressed. I am simply afraid, though, that the paralysis in Washington, D.C. may prevent us from taking advantage of what is an amazingly good opportunity that has come along unexpectedly and that we have now. It would be a tragedy, though, to miss it because of political deadlock.
And is it a battle that's going to be fought in the courts, or how would that come about?
I think that it will be fought in the courts. I think that there will be fought out in Congress. There's the possibility that that the parties could find some area of agreement around the soot problem, because it's not only a climate change problem, it's a significant public health problem as well. And even some of those politicians who are climate deniers have been willing to support efforts to reduce soot and black carbon, mainly as a public health issue. So there's some opportunities here to reach out and cross over the traditional divides. I'm not wildly optimistic, but it could happen. But the public needs to be much more aware of the issue, and so that's one of the things I'm going to try to do tonight, is talk about and explain how black carbon works and why we have this opportunity.
Well, Buck Parker, I want to thank you very much for giving us a little preview of that, and wish you luck tonight with your presentation for ILAHI. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you again for having me.
And let people know, I've been speaking with Buck Parker. He is strategic advisor at Earth Justice. He is speaking tonight at the ILAHI Lecture Series. The topic is Who Owns Your Environment? That's at 7 p.m. tonight at the First Congregational Church. And KBOO is broadcasting this event live, so you can hear it tonight on KBOO at 7 p.m. This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine. Political Perspectives.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The more rational a culture seems to be, the more irrational will be its underside when the dark times come, the veils lift, and more is revealed than most want to see. Those are the words of Michael Mead in his seminal article, Why the World Doesn't End. It is also the opening quote in another piece called The Really Big Transition, Saying Goodbye to the Enlightenment, Saying Hello to Consciousness. The author is a friend of this program, Carolyn Baker. Actually, that is Dr. Carolyn Baker, a psychotherapist in private practice and former adjunct professor of history and psychology, now living in Colorado. I hear from Carolyn every day through her email update of pithy news about a world in trouble. Carolyn also sends her solutions links with tips about things you and I can do. She's a thought leader and writer for Transition Colorado, and I promise, whatever dark times we do talk about, we'll get to some of those solutions in the end. I invited Carolyn to Radio EcoShock because I'm wrestling with my own problem, as you listeners may know. Science is telling us humans are in the process of wrecking the world for life as we know it. But very few of us are really responding. We just keep wasting the planet. We pollute the land, the sea, the atmosphere, as though there's no tomorrow, and maybe there won't be. Why is reason failing? As we look for alternatives, how can we avoid the pitfalls of past superstition, not to mention the just plain craziness so prevalent on the internet? So to help us with all that, Carolyn Baker, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's wonderful to be back. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Here on the West Coast, you can go to a retreat to believe anything.
I'm sure. I used to live in California.
And we get to a place that we call the woo-woo factor, and that's the point where people go all glassy-eyed and they're convinced that mysticism will change the world, maybe including car addiction or coal burning in China, I suppose. Is that where you want to take us?
No. You know, mysticism is making a huge return right now in modern culture, actually. If you look at the popularity of some of the mystical poets like Rumi, Kabir, Hafiz, and you just look at the kind of returning popularity of poetry in general, you kind of get a feel for this returning mysticism. And some people equate that with superstition or, you know, this is irrational. How is it going to help us solve any problems? But in fact, you know, the crux of my work is helping us bring together the scientific, the rational, with the mystical, with the beyond rational, I like to call it. Because I think that's where we're going. We're going into an age not of science or of spirituality, but an age of consciousness where the two of those are going to be integrated in a lot of different ways.
Well, it kind of reminds me of that old detective show that used to be on radio. It was somebody who was looking for the facts and nothing but the facts. But that isn't who we are.
Well, it's not only not who we are, it just is no longer appropriate in dealing with the challenges that we are being confronted with right now. You know, I've written in this article that I recently posted and that I sent you, The Really Big Transition, saying goodbye to the Enlightenment, saying hello to consciousness. I wrote in there about the Enlightenment and how it came about in the 17th and 18th centuries, why it was important in human history. But one of the legacies of